Blog Talk Radio.
You're out there probably shopping for a turkey or a ham. It seems like folks are walking away from turkey now. For some reason, turkey has a bad name, and people don't want to eat it anymore. I'm not sure why, but it seems like it's the second choice now when it comes to Thanksgiving. Welcome to One Black Man Talk. I'm Mark Elliott, been your host for quite some time now. Soon to be joined by Mr. DeMaurice and Mr. Charles. And as you know by now, we get together at least once a week, put this together, and we have some talk among ourselves that explore a male's perspective on life, love, and relationships, always shooting for the honest self-evaluation, not shying away from some things that need to be said. And that's basically it. I like the fact that as gentlemen, and then we have, you know, ladies on the show as well, that basically we get together and we just kind of let it loose. We're not afraid to be open. We find different things to talk about and bring our perspective to it. As I was saying earlier, Mr. DeMaurice, it seemed like for some reason, man, turkey is not the favorite anymore. So as Thanksgiving starts to approach, you seem like a type of guy to me, man, would have duck turkey.
A duck?
Duck.
Yeah, I'm just questioning, bro.
I've only had duck like once in my life, and that was probably 6 or 7 years ago in Germany. And I didn't realize it was duck. I'm not as sophisticated as you think I am. Yeah, you see the prices on turkeys, man? Turkey's expensive.
I'm sorry. Say the last part again to catch that one.
I said, you see the prices on turkeys?
Well, it seems like to me people are moving. I'm sorry. It seems like to me people are moving to the ham. I've talked to a variety of folks, and a lot of people are doing ham rib this time around for Thanksgiving, man. And even the past few years, I noticed turkey is not making the plate or making the table like it used to on Thanksgiving, man. Maybe let me check with Mr. Charles because, you know, this cat might be doing turkey. Mr. Charles, now you seem like a cat to me, bro. If you're going to have turkey, you're going to fry it. Am I correct, sir?
Man, you got me tripping. What? That's you, bro, talking about fried turkeys and don't eat macaroni and cheese. Are you kidding me?
Oh,
bro, what is wrong with you? What are you talking about? That's you, bro. All them unconventional things. Bro, where I go, it's real deal traditional. It's sacrilegious not to have a damn turkey. What are you talking about? Talking about ham. Ham and a turkey?
Come on, you know, Mr. DeMaurice said having turkey on Thanksgiving. Let's be honest. This brother spent some candles on having turkey, bro. Come on, let's get real.
No, I'm going to pay for it.
He might be Dr. Love and that's sophisticated. But when it comes down to getting them giblets, he going to be right there.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, whatever you share, whatever you feast on this coming Thanksgiving, enjoy it and always give thanks for us able to see another Thanksgiving. This is a show I wanted to do for quite some time, an episode I wanted to put together for quite some time. And as it started to come together, it's interesting. Most shows I come upon, it's easy to kind of lay the format out, and we've been doing this for so long, it kind of like fall into place. This one wasn't that particular one. It wasn't coming across or coming together easy. And usually I have it done earlier in the week. And for some reason, this one kind of pushed me further into the week. And it just wasn't coming together, but I knew at some point it would. And yesterday, I was working on this. And I'm putting it together. And I'm still not getting the traction mentally that I want. And all of a sudden, a good friend of mine called, a cat call, and we're talking. And I threw a question out to him, and he started sharing and going into detail, and it's just like the doors opened up, and I was like, this is it. and, you know, kind of reinforced the theory in my mind that sometimes in life, this may sound small, but I can make this sound bigger, and it's in, on a bigger stage, it is much bigger. But there's times in life sometimes when you just don't have what you need or you can't get what you need, and God will say to you, wait a minute, this is it. This is what you need. Yeah, you didn't have it yesterday, but I'm going to make sure you have it in time. You're going to have it today. And this is what happened yesterday in terms of this show. I wanted to do a show on basically why do fathers leave, and that's where I was just having a tough time trying to come across it, and I engaged in a conversation with a cat that I've known for a long period of time. I was trying to think today how long him and I have basically known each other, and it might go back to be about 25, 30 years, between somewhere 25 and 30 years, which is a long period of time. Our paths have crossed in many ways. We've worked together for a period of time. I'm not working together. We found a way to always kind of stay in touch, reinforce, talk, share, grow together. So I'm happy to welcome this cat on, but more than happy to have him come on and basically share with us, which is a topic that's not easy. You know, a lot of times men run from talking about anything if it's not other than sports or chase and tail, let's be honest. So to get us to kind of open up and share something that's really inside of us, something we experience, I don't care how macho or masculine we may come across, a lot of us are not for it. But I want to bring Mr. Leonard in because this cat is open enough to come on and share something that he did in his life a while ago. And he's learned from it, he's grown from it, and he's not afraid to talk about it. With that being said, Mr. Leonard, how you feeling, sir?
I'm feeling great. How you doing, sir?
Hey, man, you know me, man. If I wake up in the morning, I ain't got no other reason but not to feel good. So I want to appreciate you for coming here and coming on. And sure, I mean, you probably heard the two other cats I got up there, man. You know, I want to introduce you to Mr. Charles and Mr. DeMaurice. We all make up when black men talk. I want you to kind of just give you a chance, the two gentlemen, to say what's up, whatever it is, before we get down to business.
Hey, buddy, how are you?
Great to have you on the show, man. Great to have you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
That's what I'm talking about, man. That's how we do things here. Everything ain't always what it is, but it is what it is, Mr. Leonard. With that being said, you know, as we were speaking yesterday, and, you know, I've known of your life, Rob, you know of my life, so some things you said to me I knew, but some things I didn't know with in depth of what you shared. So I want to go back to, because you fall into a father, you fall into that role of a father did leave. And a lot of times we stand on the outside, you know, men and women, and we look at it a certain way, and we come up with our own thoughts and our ideas, but we never push past that and pull back the layers and try to understand or think about what may have happened. And before, you know, I get you to go into it, I came across this stat, and I didn't want to do the stat, but I came across this information, so I pushed away the stat, but I grabbed this. Because a lot of times we think something that necessarily may not be the truth. And this comes from our government, whether you want to trust them or not. But this comes from them, the Center of Disease Control and Prevention. A federal government agency published a study a while ago saying black men, compared to white and Hispanic fathers, were more involved with their children's lives. So for the longest period of time, we'll walk around thinking that people that look like us, gentlemen that look like us, we're not living up to our father responsibility. I'm not saying we don't have a lot of work to do to improve what we have done, because there's plenty of us that can do better. But when I came across that, it kind of surprised me. I'll be honest. It took me a little by surprise. And it's something, if we don't push it out there and get it out there, no one's going to push it out there for us. But facts are what they are. With that being said, sir, I'm going to come back to you, Mr. Leonard. I want you to take us back to the time of a daughter that you had. When her mother shared with you that she was pregnant, what was your initial reaction? More so than that, what were your initial thoughts, sir?
Looking back in hindsight, I think initially when I got the information, I was happy from the offset. it seems like as the pregnancy progressed, the attitude and our relationship took a turn in the opposite direction. It became more like a tug of war type of situation. You know, it was like, well, it's me and the baby and you're going to take the back seat. And that was bombarded the remaining 7 months up into the actual pregnancy situation, you know, or giving birth. So during that, it was like a paradigm shift, you know, internally I became more of an emotional recluse because, you know, at the time I felt my ego wasn't getting stroked. I felt that it's a package deal. It's like, it sounds almost like a used car salesperson trying to sell you a lemon off the lot. And given the history that we had in our relationship, at the time, that person didn't exhibit motherly attributes at the time. So as time progressed up into the pregnancy, you know, things start to sour quickly.
Let me ask this, because I know men can feel this when this kind of takes place sometimes, especially if it takes place with someone that we may not in our mind thought to want to see pregnant with our child. Did you feel at a point where this might have been something that she pre-planned, something that she wanted? I hate to use the word trap, but something that she was may have been trying to have without informing you?
That theory entered my mental way of thinking initially. Then I was like, I'm trying to give the situation the benefit of the doubt. And at the time, neither one of us were wed to each other. I was going through a separation and a divorce through my estranged wife at the time. So the timing was questionable. It was questionable on my side, and it was questionable on her side as well, given the circumstances that I was under.
All right. At what age, when your daughter was born, if it happened previously, but at what age would you say that you basically decided to walk away from the mother and the child?
It was shortly after the birth of my daughter. Like I said, it was hard. It was hard. I think initially I didn't want to own up to the possibility of me being an emotional coward or me being a self-serving type of cat that, yeah, it was a snatch and grab type of situation. And I knew long-termly the mental status of the mother wasn't in my best interest. And it was just a situation that went south quickly.
Okay. Can you name some factors, if you don't mind, that would basically, I know you spoke of the pregnancy, and some might hear that and go, okay, women hormonal, when they're pregnant, they're going to be a certain way, they're going to feel a certain way, they're going to do things a certain way. And as we're kind of feeling, or some people as men, and not some people, in general, they can say you overlook that you kind of overlook. So after the child is here, what were some of the factors that made you decide, you know what, I need to walk away?
It was safe to say that the person that I was romantically involved had some mental deficits. Beknownst to me, I didn't know that the person had episodes with bipolarism and schizophrenia. And at that juncture in the time, I fell to want to go to another level with her.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not sure. You said, if you don't mind repeating, you said at this time you fell to do what? That kind of, on my end, it broke up. Lows. Repeat that one more time.
I felt that I couldn't go to another level with her, given her mental capability at the time.
Okay. Now, when you walked away, let's say shortly thereafter, or the times that you were away, what were some things that you felt being away from your child? Because we assume, there again, when this happens for a cat, when he walks away from his child, that he necessarily doesn't care about the child. You know, he's not thinking about the well-being. So what I want to kind of get us into is that mindset. What were you thinking or your thoughts of the child while you was away from the mom, or from the child and the mom?
It was a tug of war. It was a tug of war because I grew up in a very therapeutic, family-orientated situation. And I had second-guess myself after I walked away. I just felt bad. I felt bad, especially during the holiday times, and during the time that she was taking her first steps and you know, those classic Kodak moments. So I harbored a lot of guilt, and I harbored a lot of resentment.
Yeah. Hey, again, bro, I want to thank you for, because, again, I'm sure this just can't be to kind of walk back through. Wondering, though, because, you know, when we were talking yesterday, and you said a little while earlier, in a sense, how you weigh about you, but how did you, when looking back and thinking, I know you said there was a coward way, and people have kind of walk away, did you feel a sense of shame, anything of that nature?
Definitely felt a lot of shame. I felt a lot of confusion. The shame, the guilt, and it's spilt over to resentment. And, you know, a lot of deep denial. I could not deny that I had an active part in creating this life. But therefore, I didn't have an active stance in trying to establish a foundation for this child that we created. It seemed like it was just a one-sided type of situation.
Okay.
From the offset.
You know, it's interesting, man. I saw a picture of you and your daughter not too long ago, man, and bruh, split an image. I'm serious, man. Share with us how old she is now and some things that has been done, if there's just some things that are done to kind of, for you and her, to bridge a gap and to strengthen a relationship between you and her.
Well, the grace of God, she's a young adult. She's in her early 20s, and we reconnected about 3 years ago. And it was like a 360-degree change. I still harbor a lot of resentment. I still harbor a lot of guilt. And there's a lot of backlash for those missing years that I missed out on her from puberty to adulthood into those Kodak moments. So it's now filling in those voids and filling in those blank holidays that I didn't partake in. And it's a struggle, but it's a healthy struggle. And I can see some resolve at the end of the tunnel. I'm given the opportunity to honor the gift that God has bestowed, you know, in my travels. And, you know, I'm given a clean slate to try to bridge the gap and try to establish a better meaningful relationship during the absence of her life at the time.
One thing you said you brought up that towards the end of our conversation yesterday that you brought up that drew me for a loop in the sense that we don't talk about this much from a male perspective. And I think women bring this up more than we do. But you threw the word out, fornication.
Oh, yeah.
Sexual between people not married to each other. And it was when you dropped it, I was like, damn. And as men, we spend a good portion of our lives, whether we want to honor or say it or not, just trying to have sex, bro. We just do, and we don't look at it being a form of fortification or fortification. We don't. And I'm going to let you share what you said to me about it, and then I'll ask some more. But here again, I can't even remember, honestly, man, a last time I've heard a brother say that word. And usually you hear it from the mouth of a woman. So when you said it, I'm like, whoa. And I'm sure in most of our minds run from it and act like it doesn't exist. But here again, I'll allow you to say what you said and why you said it, please.
It wasn't a full-fledged relationship. It was based strictly on physical needs and physical wantfulness at the time. So we were fornicating. You know, it was a situation that went awry quickly.
It's interesting, man, because I think that, you know, and this is nothing that I'm just pushing out there based on what you said and we're talking about it, but I think some things when we tend to not notice, such as fornication, so that things will come out of that that we're just not aware of. And sometimes we put ourselves in situations not paying to and adhering to these things for such things to happen. And I'm not going to be any more descriptive than that. And I think sometimes we need to go back to the basic fundamentals and the basic principles as men and adhere to it. And I think that would kind of level our waters out some. Bro, I'm not going to hold up more of your time. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing. Again, you know, it's not easy. I totally understand that. And this is what we've been doing for the past several years, man. As brothers, we get on and we talk about stuff and we go through stuff that's not easy. And when I say we don't shy away from saying what needs to be said, you know, it's real, man. We don't basically avoid some things. And I'm always pleased when anyone comes up here and takes on that same mental approach, that same mindset. It's not afraid to shy away and basically reveal. So kudos to you, bro. I appreciate it. You know, I'll be in touch. Like I said, we've been going back and forth for years, man. Sorry about that.
For years, definitely.
Yes, sir, man. For years, brother. And that will continue. I'm going to, before you get out of here, though, I want to see if Mr. Charles, Ms. DeMaurice have something they want to say, and then we'll cut you loose, bro. Certainly. I'll come to you first, Mr. DeMaurice.
Yeah, one of the interesting things the brother mentioned is what a lot of brothers mention is that we get into these relationships and sometimes the mothers shift gears because they are the gatekeepers. Society looks at them as the first nurturers or the parent that the child is going to be with and the better parent. And sometimes in the legal and policies and societal kind of rules, we get the short end of the stick. But one of the things I've learned over the years, because I've been in a similar situation where the mom's playing the gatekeeper and, you know, kind of melding in, like, if you're not in a relationship with me, you can't be in a relationship with your child, which is two separate relationships, the child gets older and starts to see what's going on. And you know, and then they make the relationship and they make the connection with the dad. So it's a lot of brothers that go through that. And it's good that the statistics that you brought out, I thought that was great. And that it's not always the dude just walking away. Sometimes the circumstances are that the mother wants him away because the relationship is not there. And if you're not either paying the amount of money that she wants or doing what she wants because she is the gatekeeper and in control, then she's like, okay, I'm going to punish you by keeping you away from something I know you love. And so I hope that story gets out a lot more than the negative story about black men just walking away from their responsibilities.
A very good point there, Mr. DeMaurice, because that goes on And usually when that happens, men don't speak up about it. They tend to just kind of roll with it, don't say anything, and it doesn't get shared. It doesn't get out there. But you're right, a lot of cases have been put forth to where if you don't do X, Y, Z, you know, you can't do B, C, and D. I will say this, though. I will say this, you know, this is just me. And I know we have, as men, we have a thought process that the court system has set up against us. But I will say to any cat out there dealing with that, drag her ass into court. Because what women may not realize, or we may not realize, when you're getting child support, you're paying 50%, she pays the other. So when it even comes down to child support, you're paying 50%. Even if it comes down to custody, it could be 50%. So if she wants to play that game with you, take her ass to court and file for joint custody. Because sometimes you have to go in and show them you're just not going to stand by and be passive because your kid is at stake. And don't allow them to basically use what they're thinking they can get over you on and use the kid as a pawn. And I don't think as men we do that enough. I just don't think we do. I think we kind of just realize we're up against it. They're not there. Even if you go and it doesn't work out, do it anyway for the sake of your kid. Don't let them just basically muscle you and say, well, if you don't do X, Y, Z, no, because the responsibility to raise a child is 50% on every level. And when you basically allow someone to take your level away, now take their ass to court, bro. Don't be afraid to take and do what you got to do because there's a lot of men have done it and got things turned around in their favor. There's a lot of men have done it and got sole custody of their kids. I know a cat. Noah Cat has done that. A few, actually. So sometimes we stop and just think, okay, because, you know, they had it, it came out of their womb, our rights aren't what they are. But let me tell you, we have some rights. Mr. Charles, I want to bring you in for the last word of this. Sir, we'll change gears.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I can only imagine how difficult that was to – you know, be away from his daughter the way that he had to. But most importantly, I'm glad that he mentioned that he and his daughter have reconnected and they're building their relationship or they have a relationship because no matter what it is, children still need their fathers and their parents, especially girls. They need their parents in their lives because it helps them continue to develop. And I'm glad that's happening because there's so many children, unfortunately, that do not have a chance to reconnect, and when they do, it's usually strained. And at the end of the day, it really is about the love, man, because there's so many kids that really need their parents, no matter when they're in their lives or for how long. They just really need them.
Absolutely. I'll say this to you, Ms. Lynn, before I go. The times you shared to me about your daughter, bro, Father, God has done an awesome job with her, man. Your daughter is strong mind, strong will. You got some work at it, bro, because you're going to make sure you stay on top of your toes, man. And I love it, man.
But
we'll talk soon.
I appreciate you coming on, bro.
I'll catch you with you soon.
I thank you all for the tremendous feedback and the insight. And you guys have a happy holiday.
Same to you, boss. I'll catch you with you soon.
Same to you, brother.
We'll catch a little break. We'll take a little break. We'll come back on Black Man Talk. Me to start thinking, Mr. Charles, in a sense, because I wonder, as men, are we prepared and guided to become a dad? Because when we're younger, you know, we come across certain things, and some things that we learn may not necessarily be spoken to us. You know, we kind of pick it up on the run. We do our own modification. We change things a little bit. But I don't know if anyone sometimes prepare us. And I know we learn a lot by watching. And I think, you know, all of us had our fathers. Us three had our fathers. So we picked up on a lot of different things. But I can speak for myself when I think about, you know, the father that I became or the father that I am. Wasn't necessarily the foundation as far as words or guiding me. It didn't come from my father. My father was, you know, awesome dad. But it wasn't like he said, this is what you do as a father. This is how you want to handle things as a father. I mean, I've watched him and learned a lot from him, but he never, you know, gave me the book that he had hidden in the closet about being a dad. So I'm wondering, as men in general, you know, are we prepared or guided in a sense to be a father, Mr. Charles?
I think most of us probably are not, because when you are thinking about being a dad, that means you're usually thinking about being married or something or whatever. And some people might get those lessons, but especially with some of our folks, we just sometimes, I know my dad, you know, even though I don't have children, but I've definitely taken a lot of kids under my wing, gave them advice, and they come to me a lot, relatives and whatnot, and talk to them about, like, you know, in a dad role. But I don't think, well, I know I did not receive that. And I don't think a lot of us do. But as you hit on a very valid point, watching and paying attention kind of showed me what I thought I should do for children, even from something that may come from outside the actual parents. And what I mean by that is the fact that, one, it doesn't take a lot. I mean, we all were children at one point, right? And we know how we felt about some things. And you know how certain things that didn't go right, or maybe your parents didn't follow through, or they couldn't do something for you. You know how you felt. So I always would try to put myself in the mindset of how a child is thinking, but also thinking, too, that there's a way to go about it. And I was talking to a younger cousin yesterday, literally. He was so accustomed to, when things weren't going right, to arguing, screaming, debating and hollering at what is and arguing with his mom or whoever it was. That's the way that they communicated, and they never really at the end got anywhere. And we had a conversation one time, and he started kind of raising his voice, and I was like, nah, we don't do that, bro. Nobody's stopping you. I said, if you want to scream, you go back to where you got that from. But the premise of it was to let him know that this is a discussion, trying to help you out. But showing him, too, at the end, we're trying to help you improve, but in the end, we're still going to be here. We still love you. And that's what we talked about yesterday. He was like, yeah, I was a kid. I couldn't see it. And I said, but now look at you. Look how you have advanced. So the point of it is learning, being aware, paying attention to great models that you saw before you, because there's great examples, I'm sure we all have seen. And there are some bad examples of parenting. So I look at both of them and kind of connect it all together and try to be the best support person or support system that I can be.
Good stuff there, bro. You're right. You do kind of look at the good, well, as the bad, and you kick out the bad and know that's not what you want to be. And the good, you want to be better than the good. You aspire to be better than the good and to want to reach a level that's better than the good. Mr. DeMaurice, you know, here again, man, it's not something, you know, that we may have been prepared for. And I remember when I was younger, there were books out, and Bill Cosby wrote a couple of books on it about being a dad. I'm like, I'm not sitting down reading no damn book about being a dad. I'm sorry, man. I'm just not. And I'm not saying that's for other cats, whatever the case may be. But, you know, something I think instinctive inside of you, like Mr. Charles said, that, you know, as a child, you know what hurted you, what didn't hurt, relate to. And I'm always amazed that when cats didn't have something as a child, that they basically would pass that on to their children. I don't get that, because I always felt like you know, our people, you know, our people, I mean, our aunts, our uncles, they laid the foundation for us to be what we are. But at the same time, they laid the foundation for us to be what we are, but would be better than what they were, not the same level. They always wanted us to be better. They want us to rank up higher. So if you were ranked down low, in a sense, why would you want to have your seed ranked down even lower than you were at the same level? You would think the mindset would be you want to rank up higher, I should say. With that being said, Mr. Reese, you know, I don't know if we were actually prepared or guided to be a father. Now, it's funny because, you know, if you got with your friends, they would guide you on basically how to do certain things with women or girls or whatever the case that may be. But very seldom, I don't think, as men, we got around and talked to each other, when I'm become a father, I'm going to do it like this. So the question comes back to, you know, how do we develop being a dad if we weren't prepared or guided to be one?
Yeah, you're right. We weren't socialized to be that. But I think what we did, what I know I saw is, and I got was what it was that you had to do to be a man. And I guess in their own way thought that that's the way that they were passing down some things. But one of the things that I started to do was I started to watch men. I watched my father and how his parenting style was, and wanted to take the good things that I thought would work. And I started to reflect as I was becoming a father for the first time, started to reflect during that nine-month period. You start to think a lot of stuff like, okay, how am I going to do this? And it's not necessarily in the book. And I started reflecting on my Uncle Fred, and being in his household and how he parented and lessons and things of that sort. And then I also picked up stuff from my grandmother, my mother, and other folks. And one of the things that was a recurring theme that I felt that worked best in any situation is being patient and listening. Those were the two things that I picked up. Being patient and listening, and not say that the folks that came before me was always like that, but I noticed that worked for me. If somebody was really patient with me and they really listened to me, I would be more inclined to talk to them, confide in them, and to share with them what was going on with me in order to get help. And so any person, I noticed that in my uncles, on both sides of the family, that cousins, older cousins who were patient, they listened, they would give you, everybody, you're kind of, as a man, you're kind of taking bits and pieces of everything, all the information and data that you're getting, and you're putting that together to come up with your way of doing things as far as being a father and a parent. And so that's what I found myself doing. It wasn't like they were saying, do this, do that, do that. You were looking at their example. You were trying to figure out what works and what didn't work, whether it was you or whether it was your friends or whether it was your cousins or relatives. And then as you're becoming, I took a lot of time thinking about this. As I was becoming a father, I'm like, okay, what do I want to give to this child? Because I realized in my spiritual walk that this child was loaned to me, and it's loaned to me for a specific reason, help guide them as best as I could into adulthood and being a productive citizen. And so that I did not own this child, even though this child was coming from me biologically, the child is spiritually not mine. So what did I have to do to make sure that whatever small role I was playing in their lives or big role or whatever, that they were getting the lessons they needed to move forward. And like you said earlier, to be better than I was. And that was, I took that as my assignment. So when we talked earlier about the mothers being a gatekeeper, I noticed that a lot of mothers like take ownership of their children. Like, I own you and you do everything I say. I didn't take that kind of leeway, and it relieved a lot of pressure off me when I wasn't with them all the time. Like, okay, every time I'm with them, how can I show them something or prepare them for a time where they're not around me that they can make great decisions on their own? So, yeah, you're right. We don't get the playbook, but I feel sometimes that there are a lot of examples around us that can help us kind of put things together and come up with a, you know, best practices on how to do this fathering thing.
You touch on some very strong things, man, that I don't think that a lot of us associate our kids with. And when you say they were loaned to us from God, that's it, bro. Because it's a gift, you know, your body, what your body did with that woman allowed you to bring forth a gift. And that's why we are built the way we are. That's why physically we are who we are, and physically who they are, who they are. And as men, we tend to, you know, of the attraction that they provided for us to have the children, we've taken that and used that in a selfish manner. We just have. And even when that happens, where they become pregnant, a child has come, it's interesting that for a lot, we don't make that connection where that's given to you to, like, as you said, to bring up and make better and be something here in this world. And they have gifts that need to be flourished that they may not even understand that they have. And it's our roles, our duty, it's our obligation, our responsibility that makes them see that and to basically prop them up to be what the best they can be. And when we walk away and just turn our back on that, we're not only doing the child a disservice, we're doing God a disservice. We really are, because there's no way he will allow, or I would believe he would allow a child to come here to a man and a woman and expect the man to walk away. There's been many great stories where women have been raised, I mean, women raised children, or a child has been raised to go on to do great things without their dad. There's a lady in the state of Connecticut. We talked about her. I think her name is Jana Hayes, if I'm not mistaken. But we talked about her a couple of years ago. I remember reading the story when she won Teacher of the Year. She grew up in a house where, as a child, everything around, I don't believe her father was there, and everything was going on. And as she went to school, the teachers in the school took a liking to her and wanted her to be better than what her atmosphere was. And they made sure from each grade, they made sure she did well. They did what they had to do in school and out of school to help her maintain a good grade average, a good core life. And they moved her through. So she grew up, she became a teacher. And with not only just became a teacher, she actually won Teacher of the Year or the whatever the award is. I can't think of it correctly right now. But this woman went on to win that award for the country. That award propelled her to meet then the elect president, President Obama. She came from that and decided to run for Senate. And she's a senator now for the state of Connecticut. And I look where basically how, in spite of everything that was going on with her in her life when she was younger, how God he did put a circular fence around her. And he sent in others to help her to get where she needed to be, where he wanted her to be, to give her an opportunity. So, and I'm thinking that, I'm saying to myself, he did that because the person that he wanted to help her do that, the father, where was he? He couldn't count on him. He knew he couldn't count on him, so he sent these others in. So I go back to what I just said a little while ago. I don't think that we really kind of understand as men that that child that's given, and you could basically do what you do to get it here. It could have been a big button, a smile, whatever, to get that child here. But when that child comes out, that becomes your obligation to make sure that child gift is brought upon, to brought out, to raise, to cherish, to love, to nurture. Because that's what we're here for, basically. That's really what we're here for. So I'm going to come back to this, Mr. DeMaurice, in a sense, because we've all had our fathers in our lives. But let's just imagine for a second, if we can. Let's imagine that, you know, you go back and you wipe all that away. Go back to the age of 3 or 4, where you can remember, and wipe in existence that you knew of your dad away, if you could, mentally. And imagine what you might be today. Imagine your fears what might be today. Imagine how your life would be different. If you can, share that with us, sir.
Yeah, it would probably be drastically different. But I remember there was a two to three-year period my mom and dad weren't together, and I rarely saw my dad. I mean, rarely. It might have been during a Super Bowl or a holiday where he would stop by, things of that sort. There were other men that stepped in my life. You know, you had teacher, Mr. Freeman, back in New Haven, Connecticut. He was a father figure. He's like one of the only men in our school who was teaching. And I was honored to be in his class, you know, in the fifth or sixth grade or something like that. I had uncles, cousins. I had on both sides of the family who would check in with me. I had friends' fathers who would, you know, pay attention to me, and both parents. But it'll probably be a little bit different, I think, because a lot of the stuff that I do and I say and the way I act is a lot like my dad, man. And, I mean, it's almost identical. And there are times I'm talking to my cousins on my father's side of the family, and he was like, man, you sound just like your daddy. You know, you're doing this just like your daddy. The other ironic thing about it is that I have a brother who's older than me who we share the same dad. Even though he wasn't around my dad a lot, you can see the mannerisms. It's in the DNA, bro. The mannerisms, the attitude, the, you know, certain things that he says and does. And sometimes I'm around my dad and him. And my dad sometimes is like, where do you get that from? I'm like, what do you think? What do you think? You know, and it's like he wasn't there during the childhood, but it's almost like in the DNA, like certain things that he does, he says, his mannerisms, you know, it's in there. It's in there somewhere deep inside. And even he would say, you know, I don't know where I get this from. And his mother would say, you know, your dad was like that. Your dad did that, even though not meeting him. So I think some of it comes in the DNA. But I think also, I would have been much different. I would have been different. I know I would have been different. But there were always men. The Creator always put me around men, football coaches, basketball coaches, you know, like relatives, cousins, things of that sort, that march you to that journey of manhood. And you got a lot of things from that. I remember back in my early teens when, you know, I was getting a lot of stuff before going to high school, and my dad's brother came up and said, hey, come and live with me for a couple of years. You know, he could see it. He could see what the road I was going down and how big a influence that was being there for 2 years in his household. So, yeah, I think it would have been different. I don't know how it would have been different, but I think it would have been different. But like I said, the men that is still to this day, the men that I'm around, the men that I associate with, you know, are like father figures and guiding you and giving you examples. So, that's a great question, man. But I would like to see how it would have been different and able to see both tracks and kind of see what the differences were.
I would concur, man. There's a lot about you and your father that real similar. But I'm glad there's one thing you're not that your father is. And that's a damn Dallas Cowboy fan, bro. I'm just thankful that you Man, I'm thankful. Because you could have been. You could have been because your father's a huge Dallas Cowboy fan. So I'm thankful.
Oh, yeah.
You veered off. You veered off when it came to that, my brother. You veered off. Mr. Charles, just imagine how you could have been, how things could have been different and how it could have changed and altered your life if your dad was not there.
Wow, that's a deep one. That was my guy. So many regards. He taught me so much that no one else ever did. I don't think I would have been as strong a person. And I think I kind of would have probably been okay because I did have relatives who kind of showed me a way. But I don't think I would have been as strong. I don't also think I would have been – I'm not sure how comfortable I would have been in being my own self, being the man's man in regards to being confident in who you are and how you go about your business despite what's in front of you, and having self-confidence. It took me a while to kind of come to the point where I really was confident in understanding life and really knowing what I was capable of doing in this structure. But, yeah, my father, because we spent so much time together with my mom passing so early, he was like everything. So, yeah, that would have been a rough one, because with other relatives even trying to show you the way, not like your dad, man. You know what I mean? I mean, whatever, however they went about it or whatever their approach might have been, for those that really were involved with your life and showing you some things, there's nothing to me like the lessons that you learned from your father, particularly when there were some good things. I mean, nobody's perfect. I love when DeMarie said, you know, my dad may not have been perfect, but he's perfect for me. Amen to that. I mean, my father's perfect for me. Because it could have been different. I could have had more stuff. We could have had more money. But the lessons are so valuable. You know, they're priceless. And I think about stuff I go through now. Man, probably be in the corner crying some damn where. Drinking, probably being drinking, doing something crazy, maybe being an alcoholic, abusing women, a lot of stuff. But because of the lessons that he provided with me, I knew I didn't need to do that. I could still be comfortable in my own skin and maintain what I needed to do as a man because of what he taught me.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm going to probably lean on two things about my dad that I don't think I probably would have as much, or have maybe not at all. My dedication to basically seeing something through or working on something, that I definitely, you know, probably wouldn't have. It's interesting because my father had a great work ethic, and I probably, you know, even now, my work, I'm a work, I don't want to work. So, and I probably only work because of his work ethic. So if he didn't have that, and I noticed that and picked up on that, and me not want to work as much as I want to work, I probably wouldn't work at all, bro. I'd have been looking to get out of work as much as I can, finding other things to do. Who knows what route that would have took me to basically, you know, not basically work hard. You know, I remember my father said a difference. He said this to me, but he said this to others about myself and my brother, Larry. He said, Larry will go to work and get dirty. He said, Marcus going to try to find a job. If he got to work, he got to be clean. He don't want to be dirty. You go to work.
Wait, now,
he'll work. He don't want to get dirty. He going to find the right job. And I swear, my father ain't never lied. He ain't never lied, my brother. It's like, it is what it is. So, you know, we're grateful and we're beyond blessed to have had fathers that chose not to walk away when they could have, that chose not to turn their back and move away for whatever the reason may be. And, you know, I could speak for my father. I'm not saying he was nowhere close to perfect, and he set a stage where I'm sure many times he wasn't happy with my mother. Many times he wasn't happy with my mother. He set the tone for it, but there were times that he wasn't happy, and he could have easily said throughout those times, you know what, I'm going to take off. I'm going to walk away. I'm not gonna put up with this. Because I need my own peace of mind. And for his reasons, he chose not to, and I'm grateful that he didn't. He didn't walk away. And this is mere presence being there really allowed me to be who and what I am today. Gentlemen, let's take a little short break. We'll come back with the questions. This is When Black Men Talk, Mr. DeMaurice, Mr. Charles, and, of course, I'm Mark Elliott. Thank you for giving us a listen. after weeks such as this, I'm almost kind of know where you may go, Mr. DeMaurice, with your question, your first one. But we're going to go there, bro, if you want to go there. Your first question, Mr. DeMaurice.
It's not really a question. It's something I ran across maybe a couple of weeks ago watching a news story on ABC. I think it's Nightline. And our mother's side of the family are what they call Gullah Geechee from South Carolina. And I know my father used to tease my mother about it all the time. And when we talk about climate change and how it affects folks, it affects the folks of our forefathers and mothers with the coastal Carolina and what's happening there. The big crop there is rice, and I cannot remember a time growing up where we didn't have rice on the pot, on the stove. And that's one of the major crops of the South Carolinians. And they were the first to probably touch the shores of the United States when they enslaved our people. And so I want to give a prayer and thoughts to them as they try to battle the government there to keep their land and to try to heal the land there so they can make money. They struggle to get ownership of the land, and now it seems like the government and the powers that be are trying to take the land from them. And one of the things that really struck me and hit my heart is one of the sisters there who was like, you know, we be Gullah Geechee. We're anointed people. The water we and the water we return. And so trying to stay claim in the land that they cultivated for all these years. And I know we've heard this, as our grandmother used to say this all the time, to make a way out of no way. And these are folks that made a way out of no way. They were brought here and given nothing, and they made a way out of no way. And it just seems like every time we do that as a people, it's being taken away from us, from somebody, powers that be, or the people who don't want us to have. So I just wanted to put that thought out there.
Very strong thought, man. Thank you for bringing it to our attention, because that one got by me. I wasn't aware of that at all. So, yeah, thank you. I'm always kind of seeing this for something, because it amazes me how, like here in Connecticut, and the Indians came back and wanted, you know, just due for them being here, and their land was taken away from them. And Connecticut said to them, I'm not sure if the Indians wanted it or not, but they gave them a right to open casinos here in Connecticut. And they said, from that, give us a pot of gold, of money, each month. But you can open that and call it your own, manage it, and do whatever. I don't know where in this country where, based on a country we built, our ancestors built, put together, manufactured, put together, where we have gotten anything where it's ours based on that. So, you know, when you're talking and saying that, this is what I'm thinking. I thought this before. It's like, it's interesting. Even with the casinos, they still got their hands in it. It should just be the Indians. It should be nothing to do. It should be, you don't put your hand in the pot. It should be theirs. But it's way it's set up to where, if they can't make something off of it, if they can't rape it or steal it, it's no value to them. If you want to respond, Mr. Charles, we'll listen, sir.
Yeah, it's, it's interesting from the standpoint of the heritage of your family is so important. I think that's vital. And when I heard DeMaurice mention that, and he mentioned it to me before as well, that so many of us are not aware. We don't know our heritage. We don't know our people. And to know that they took stands and still take stands for what they believe in says a lot. And I think we should continue to share that with our future leaders, our children, cousins, what have you, that are coming along. We need to share that with them so they have a base of where they come from. And I think when you know where you're coming from and the strong base of people that you, where you started from and their tradition and heritage and whatnot, it allows them to be stronger people because they understand that they're just adding to a great legacy. And oftentimes I don't think we do that. Other people do it all the time. Oh, my grandfather came over here from Italy and he was this, that, and that. You don't often hear that about African-Americans. We do more of that. Because we come from some great people, taking out a lot of crazy-ass situations, and we still stand. Not only stand, we thrive.
Good stuff. Mr. Charles, your question, sir.
Okay, kind of generic question. My question is, we all three have been on this earth for quite some time, and we had to make some decisions. So my question is there anything, I'm not going to say regret because life is what it is, but is there anything you could do over in your life that was important or whatever, would you, what would it be?
Wow, man. I'm going to try not to state the obvious, so. Wow. I think, you know, I believe if I could go back, there's been times I've thought this, and I never kind of wanted this for whatever reason, but as I age, I look back and thought, you know, you'd have been a good lawyer to help people. You know, a real good lawyer to help folks out. So if there's something that, if I look back now, was given an opportunity to become or do, it would be a lawyer. It would be a lawyer. And it's not something, again, that when I was younger I had desire for, anything that felt I was called for or wanted. But just something over the years, because to me, the way they take law and manipulate it to get things done, to basically take those that they want to take and work the system to make it for that person's favor. Something about that intrigues me. And that's a battle that I probably would have wanted to take on head on. So, yeah, I guess if, you know, I had to do something over, that would be it. Your response, Demon Reese?
Man, if I'd known how much it would have hurt Mark, me taking a Matchbox car years later, I wouldn't have taken a Matchbox car.
Yeah, okay.
If I'd known the pain it would have caused him. No.
Yeah, okay. You did it when you did it anyway.
I can't apologize enough. But I was sitting here thinking, I was thinking this the other day too, is I wish I would have recognized my worth a lot earlier in my life than I did. I think it would have propelled me into greater things. So I wish I would have recognized my worth and who I am and whose I am a lot earlier than I did. Because I think when you don't do that, you really shortchange yourself in life, and you shortchange yourself on your abilities and what you can do and your capacity. So I wish I would have really, really, really known how much I was worth. Early.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. That's going in pretty deep right there, bro. Pretty deep. Mr. Charles.
Yeah, I got a couple things I could have went with. I think I would say that I would have probably somewhat similar, but I would have said I wish I would have trusted myself earlier and believed in myself more. Because it took a long time. I was kind of even to the point of I had the ability to do some things like being an entrepreneur earlier in life, but I was always nervous or scared or afraid of something, you know, or didn't think I could do it, or even come to the point where I had a lot of doubt. And it was because I didn't believe in myself enough. And I should have just done that. There's so many things, and the sad thing about it was I practiced these things, from sports to whatever, to even life. I had practiced. I really put the work in. But then when it came time to really perform and develop and just do it, because I was prepared for it, I just didn't do it. I just kind of shrunk into, I really didn't have the confidence to do a lot of things. And it really hurt me because, not hurt like in emotional hurt, but it hurt me because I could have developed so much more to this point. And I think back like, man, why don't you just go ahead and do that? And then I knew, too, when I didn't do it, somebody else did it. Or they would take a spot, and I'm like, well, that's your spot because you were better. But it took me a while to understand it, and once I got it, it was great. But could have been a lot more further ahead and done a lot more, but I believe also things happen for a reason. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to throw a question out that you probably haven't ventured into a while. If there's someone that you can sit and break bread with, who would that someone be and why, Mr. Demaris?
Oh, dead or alive?
Yeah, either or. We'll go either or.
I think I probably said this before, but, man, I would Prince Rogers Nelson. I want to sit with that brother and just pick his brain and talk to him about not only music but life, man. And because, I watch interviews with him and through his music, man, that brother was just so deep. He was just so deep and just so far ahead of time, man, that I know people aren't in conspiracy theories, but I felt that, a lot of people didn't want him to be here because he was set to revolutionize. He did revolutionize the music business, the music industry, on owning your masters and all that other stuff and building a studio in his house. And the record company's trying to charge him for studio time. He's like, no, I made this on my own. I don't owe you any money. And so I think with that kind of thought and his foresight, I'll give you an example. DMX, the late DMX who just passed away, he explained a situation where he met Prince. And Prince, just motioned him over. He said, I talked to him about an hour and a half, 2 hours, about owning his music. Just owning his music, and this is what you need to do, and this is what you need. He said that was that Prince was the most gangster guy he met in the music business on how to do business. And so I would love to have a conversation with him and meet him and his music process and his creativity, things of that sort. I would have loved to sit down and break bread with him.
It's interesting. I was, for some reason, I was on YouTube today, and I just typed his name in. And I looked at one of his concerts. It was done in 2013 in Switzerland. And I got to admit, that was a hell of a show. The horns alone, man. I got to give that cap, right? Credit. That was a hell of a show. I'm going to kind of stay in the same vein, but a person that's from a different era, Ray Charles. To be lack of vision, and to be that talented and to be able to move around this country when people that look like him didn't have the freedoms to do whatever, but he had a savviness about him. He had a business smart about him, a shrewdness that for his day and time, it's hard to believe. And you look back and you realize he was doing it at a time when, others were more afraid. He couldn't see, but he was getting it done. So just to be able to kind of hear him speak of his strength, what he thought about, how he viewed things back then, how he wanted to move himself and knew where he wanted to go and what he wanted to accomplish. And mainly not letting the fact that he couldn't see be a deficit and getting it done. Yeah. Mr. Charles, your response, sir.
Yeah, the first two names that came to my mind, I was thinking Malcolm X, and then I thought about James Brown. Because that music, just the fact that to learn how he put that stuff together, the music and just all the beats would just, I'd be a student sitting there alone. But then again, I started thinking that what's the reality of this for me? Probably had to be my mother, man. And the fact that I didn't never really get a chance to really know her, just to sit down with her and ask her questions and ask her about what she thought about my life, that would be, oh, my God, I'd just be crying, man, the whole time. Just to see what she thought. What was she thinking? Because when you've never had that in your life and then you get that experience, you just wonder, like, my God, she could teach me, tell me so much that I didn't know. And just the a reassurance of so many things. But, yeah, that would be an amazing feat. So, yeah, my mom.
Good stuff. Another question for me, Mr. DeMaurice.
Yeah, man. The one that got away, man, give out the name and a brief situation on what happened. The one that got away. Yeah, let's hear it. Let's hear it. There you go.
Yes, sir.
You want the truth. Let's come on out with it.
Give me a second to kind of put this together and think about something. let me think. Well, I'll tell you. I thought this one got away. Well, later in life, I thought this one got away. I did, because it goes back to early on. You asked for a name, I got to drop a name. The name was Ray. Her name was Ray. For some reason, at a younger age, seeing her, instant attraction. Instant. You know, I don't know if you guys experienced this when you were young, but it's funny how when you were a young boy, you would see a girl, and you automatically would make her your wife in your head, but you didn't do that when you get older. But if you're young, you would do that. Oh, that's going to be my wife. You know, you think that's your wife, but you got older, you got smarter. You stopped doing that. But anyway, looking at her, I was like, okay, wait. And didn't know her name. She could be my wife. So as I aged, one night was hanging out, and to my surprise, I remember we went to different schools. She went to a Catholic school. You know, I went to the basic elementary, but would just kind of get flashes every now and then. It would just be a short flash, but those flashes would last for a long period of time. And basically, as we age, I guess to move up to about 20, a little older than maybe around that time, came across her one night outside of a club. Just walked up, said something casually. She said something casually back and just walked away. I was like, whoa. One night, New Year's Eve, I'm at this spot, maybe a year or two later, and who's there? But Ray. And it started. It started, it would go on for a while, and Ray had, at the time, Ray had two kids. And I had one kid. And in my head, I was thinking about, you know, merging it together. And Ray had a son that I just couldn't see myself stepping in and kind of really handling that situation. And I said to myself, I'm going to step in, I'm going to step out. And I chose to step out. But in the back of my mind, I always wonder, was Ray the one? Just wonder, you know, in the back of my mind. Even when I went on to get married, there would be times I thought Ray was the one. And I remember after being married for a couple of years, came across Ray, and she, you know, I was married, and gave her a ride. I was talking, and basically said that to her, that, you know, I might have made the wrong decision. And she was like, no, Mark. She said, you'll always be in my heart. But no. So even after she said that, I still thought about it for a while, and life went on, the case may be. Several years ago, ran into Ray again. Had a chance to hang out with Ray. And we had a chance to do a couple of things. And that period of time, you know, the last time I had a chance to come across her, I knew what took place. Took place was right. Ray didn't get away. It wasn't meant for her and I. And it was just, it was funny in a way where when I came across her again, the last time, it was in church. I always knew that she was kind of in church, and I went to a church not knowing she was going to be there, but she was there. So we started up, and again, it was proven to me that she wasn't. So I firmly believe that God wanted to show me that, no, she wasn't right for you. Doesn't mean she's bad, but she didn't get away. Your decision to walk away, you know, was the right thing. Mr. Charles.
Damn.
You're dropping that name as a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah, because you never know. Somebody might hear this. Like, thought it was me. Oh, my God. All right. So, anyway, let me start it up before I say the name. This particular person, they we connected, and it was cool early on. And, you know, I was not ready as a person and as a man to deal with what they had going on. We were both needed to grow as people, and I needed to. And even in the DeMaurice book, it says, you know, that you really can't be there to guide nobody. They got to grow on their own. You can't be that guy. But there are some things that I probably could have, that were already in me, that could have helped that person be better or grow as a person. I didn't have to be no father or nothing like that, too. But this person never really, I don't think, had a man in their lives that they could really depend on. And I think that sense of security would allow them to develop and grow to be, they already a hell of a woman, but they were just, there was a couple of things that were just not exactly right. But at the time, I wasn't ready for it, and I didn't want to do it. Because I'm like, man, I ain't doing that. I don't want to do that. Cause, I mean, even though I could have, I didn't want to do it. So, but they were loyal, and they were like, they would have ran to the moon and back for me. And it could have worked, I think. There's some rough patches, but it could have worked. Anyway, the person's name is Ann, A-N-N. Ann.
Hey, man, this is what we do on this show. We shoot for that honest self-evaluation. We don't shy away from some things that need to be said. With that question, Mr. DeMaurice, yeah, man, you dropped it. You know we want to hear yours. And it came first.
Yeah. Mine, I remember working at this agency on South Side of Chicago years ago, and a coworker of mine, she and I met, and she was like, you know what, I have a friend that lives on the East Coast in New Jersey that you two would be perfect for. I mean, perfect for each other. And at the time, I was like, you know, I'm already married, things like that. So she was like, the way you guys talk, the way you guys, your minds, the way you think, it's like, wow, you guys are made for each other. And so my coworker knew I wrote poetry at the time. This was before I did any books. And she used to read the poetry. She said, you need to send this to her so she can critique it, because she's into poetry, too. She's a writer, all this other stuff. She's always in Greenwich Village, you know. At the poetry spots and all that other stuff, spoken word, and she's a very great spoken word artist. So we started exchanging emails, and she started reading my stuff. I still have the packet where she critiqued and edited my stuff for my first book. And she was like, can I share some of your stuff and some of the spoken word? And I'm like, of course. And she was telling me which ones were great. So lo and behold, maybe a year or two later, I had a chance to go to a conference in Manhattan and for a week. And me and another coworker. And so I had let her know that I was going to be in town at that particular time, and maybe we can meet up for some coffee, you know, to finally see each other face to face. And she, you know, was like, cool, that'd be great. Let me know what hotel you're in, things of that sort. And I work in Manhattan, you know, and I'll come by after work. And so it was, I think the second day of the conference, I came back to my hotel room. We had hooked up that we were going to go to Greenwich Village and go out to eat and all this other stuff, you know, just to kick it on the town for her. And I think it was like, actually, it was the night before I was going to leave, actually. And you ever see those movies where somebody opens the door and the woman has her back towards the door and then all of a sudden she turns around and the hair kind of, you know, goes to the side in slow motion. You can see the woman's face. And she knocked on my hotel. Yeah, like maybe Lifetime, whatever. I opened the door of my hotel room. And I instantly knew that everything in my life was leading me up to her, but I fucked up and got married to somebody else I was not supposed to be married to. I mean, I instantly fell that way. And she and I kind of gazed at each other. We talked for a while. Then we went out on the town. I think we met about 7 o'clock. We didn't. It was about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like to her, listen, I mean, we're having a great time. I'm like, listen, you can stay over if you like. Because I know that you have to work the next day, and, you know, for you going back home and coming back, that might be a little stretch for you, because she lived in New Jersey, I think, at Hoboken, I believe. And she was like, well, she said, I would, but I don't want to violate your marriage. She said, because it could easily happen, and I don't want to be the woman that does that. And I respected her for that. But I got on the plane the next day and told my boy about it. And I'm like, that was the one that got away, because my coworker at my job was completely correct. It was like, this was the one I was supposed to be with. And this sister had everything that and more than I imagined that I wanted. And her name is Nzinga Chavez, and one of the most powerful and pro-black, pro-life, as far as African lives and a sister in the struggle that you can ever meet. And that was the one that got away.
I'm going to ask you a question, Mr. Charles, because I've heard women say this from time to time, that just like what Mr. Reese just shared, they think sometimes that men are with the woman and he may hesitate to commit, because he's afraid if he does, he's thinking someone's coming better. Someone else might pop better. Is that a legitimate thing that men tend to do?
I've heard of that. I think some men do, because of the fact that they're just not confident in who they're with. And I think that's the reason why, because if you're really with the person you think you should be with, then why would you be afraid to commit? So if you do have doubts, that means perhaps that's not the right person for you. And you've not found the person you're looking for. Like DeMarie said, he met this woman, and whatever, one time he knew, even though he was married, she's the one that got away. And if he can know that from there, if you're spending more time with somebody else, how the hell you don't know if that's who you want to be with? Or you're not certain who you are or what's going on with you?
Yeah, I'm with you there, because anyone that does that, man or woman, they're wasting other person's time. Because if you're not, you know, if you're kind of waiting around, think something is better, and you're kind of thinking that I'll commit to that person, then why are you with the person that you're with? Because they need to be there, and that has happened. So if they're not willing to commit, it says to us in an extent that they might be ready to commit. They're just not ready to commit to you. For whatever reason, you don't fit their bill of commitment. No matter, there's something about you that they don't deem worthy of a commitment. Your response, DeMaurice?
Yeah, I can see that. That, you know, I kind of do that in relationships now. If I don't see myself with the person, and if I'm with a person and I can see myself venturing off or not really feeling like this is the one, then I tend to back away from it, because I know that I may be, in a sense, blocking my blessing, being with this particular, and this came from just being married and having that situation that don't block your blessing. If this is not the person that is that you are going to be committed to, then don't waste their time. Let them go find the person that's going to be committed to them. And so that's the way I kind of do things now. If I'm with you and I can see myself with somebody else, then you're not the one. And I remember having this conversation with my daughter not too long ago when we were talking about, you know, marriage and relationships and all this other stuff. And she was like, you know, when will I know it's the time to do such and such? And I'm like, in your heart of hearts, you will know. So I can't really explain that. But you will know that this is the right person. You will feel it with every being of your existence that this is the right person that I need to be with. And that that person will feel it too. It's not going to be one-sided. And so when I experienced that before when I was married, that, you know, and it wasn't one-sided. I did not feel it was one-sided. The way we vibe and all that, it was not one-sided. But I had to have so much respect for her because we could have easily, you know, indulged. And would that have been the right thing? Do you want that on your conscience? And that's where we were at that particular point. But, yeah, if you're not really fully committed with somebody, don't waste their time and holding out for somebody else. Let them go and find their person that's going to be committed to them that they feel that same feeling for instead of wasting their time and wasting their energy in that relationship.
Good words, right, my brother? Good words. Real quick, gentlemen, we got about a minute before we went about it. Mr. Charles, we threw this question out a couple of months ago. You know, name someone that can get all your paycheck, bro. Think fast.
Damn, can you come back?
Yes, sir. Mr. D. Maurice, name someone real fast and get all your paycheck, bro. We got a minute. You got to think it fast, bro. Woo, woo, woo.
Me, because I'm retired right now. Ain't nobody getting my paycheck but me.
No,
me.
Man, see? Y'all just don't want to play right. Who you got, Mr. Charles? Who you got?
You know, she don't need my money. Tracy Ellis Ross. Let's go, girl.
I would have said Rihanna, but she would have knuckleheads.
Nah, Rihanna. You can't come back now, man. My brother. Oh, let me see here. With the seconds that allow, I'm going to say, I'm going to give this to one. Oh, believe it or not, this is going to sound a little different for me. MC Light. I'm going to say that. Different choice.
Oh, I don't know what. Very different. I don't know what God's seeing her. I mean, seeing her.
She done come a long way, bro. She done transformed.
Yes, sir.
She done transformed, bro. Not early on, but I feel you now.
Yes.
She done transformed, baby.
Stay retired, Mr. Rico. Let us enjoy this, my brother. Y'all have a good Thanksgiving. We'll catch up soon.